Welcome to the podcast. It's dedicated to making you a faster cyclist, the Ask a Cycling Coach podcast presented by Trainer Road. I'm Coach Jonathan Lee, and here with me this week, and as always, is Coach Chad Zimmerman.
Hello.
And our CEO, Nate Pearson.
Hello.
And we are here to answer more of your cycling and triathlon-related questions. You can submit them to us at trainerroad.com/podcast or use the hashtag AskTrainerRoad. We comb through as many questions as we can find, or as we get, because we get plenty of them, and then we put them into a list, and hopefully yours gets answered. We go through as many as we can. So let's get into it. But first things first, before we get into
to talk about
other people's questions, yeah, let's talk about our bodies, the fat or lack thereof or presence thereof.
So let me frame this whole thing. So we have been doing something called a DEXA body scan analysis. And what a DEXA scan is it's the gold standard for measuring body fat on your body. And basically what they do is they shoot two different types of x-rays through you. And based on how those go through your body, they can measure your body fat, bone mass, and muscle mass. And so we've been doing that since, February?
Mm-hmm.
And we've been trying to keep it up every 2 months.
Missed the last one.
Yeah, so we've been waiting for Jonathan. Now we just said, screw Jonathan. And now Chad just told us he's never doing one again. It's a lot of pressure having thousands of people listen to how fat we are.
Yeah, it is. Which, so, one second on that, by the way. People are listening to that and following us. Mm-hmm. I got called out the other day because I missed a workout on my training plan. Somebody on Strava was following all the workouts I've done. They realized that I must be doing a specific plan, which I was doing sweet spot based too. And then I got called out because I missed a workout. That was weird. So
Simon.
Yeah, you guys stopped. are.
So Simon's your newborn.
They really do care. They're paying attention, all you guys. So we thank you for that.
So when it's August 19th when we're recording this, 2016, and my last one was July 1st. That was my last test. So it's been a good 2 months. Mm-hmm. Chad, do you want me to do mine first? Or do you want to do yours first?
No, go ahead.
Okay, so I was the fattest person on the podcast, but I'm not really. I keep saying this everywhere. We just interviewed some people who are training our listeners for a software job, and I'm like, I'm not fat because we're on a webcam, and they're like, yeah, you're not fat, but they kind of have to say that. So one thing you have to know is DEXA. It doesn't just get the fat under your skin, but it gets intramuscular fat. So like, if you're more like a ribeye versus sirloin in your muscles.
And visceral fat.
Visceral fat.
Visceral fat. And that's the one that can kill you. That's the fat around your organs. And that can be a little bit harder to remove too.
And you definitely can't get that in a skinfold caliper test,
nope.
Of course.
Yeah, exactly. So what we've been doing is we do the DEXA. And the same day we do a Tanita scale, which is one of those ones you step on. And it does the electrical impedance. It like shoots electricity through your body, measures the resistance. And then based on your weight, it does some estimation of what your body fat is. And we've been doing fat calipers, which is just the subdermal fat. Is that how you say it, Chad?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Measures that. Okay, so February, DEXA, I was 23.7. April, I was 19.9. Drum roll. July, I was 15.6. So that's a good amount of drop from the last, 3 months between tests. And to give you an example of that, in 3 months, I dropped 9.5 pounds of fat, which is good. And I did
that's
the math
solid.
On that. That's just about a Big Mac a day that I wasn't eating.
Nice.
Because a Big Mac is 30, or a pound of fat is 3,500 calories. Big Mac's like, I think 350. I have to check my math. Someone's probably doing it right now and wrong, but it's around a Big Mac, 300 calories a day. When you think about it though, 300, 350, that's not that much. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like 350 calories.
It's probably easy to hit a deficit like that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about easy, but
yeah,
because your body goes, no, don't do that. And during the same test, I gained just over a pound of lean muscle mass.
Mm.
So my weight went from 193 to 184. During that same time though, too, I had my sinus surgery and my tonsillectomy, where I didn't eat for like 2 weeks. So that might actually, I lost a lot of fat in there, but I also lost a lot of muscle. And I kind of lost a lot of FTP too. I kind of, a good month and a half of that was my way fighting back to where I was before.
Mm.
So here's the interesting part for people who don't want to do a DEXA. The DEXA is when we do them for $50 each time. We go to a diagnostic center.
Yeah.
You don't need a prescription in the US. So my fat caliper, so at DEXA's 15.6 for me, fat calipers, which is kind of like the normal way that people say what body fat they are because no one does DEXA. Mm-hmm. I was 9%. So that's like, if you look up a guy that's 9% body fat, that's what I look like right now. The Tanita has two settings, an athlete setting and a regular setting. Tanita athlete, I was 10.5. And Tanita regular, I was 15.6. So again, Tanita regular, 15.6. DEXA, 15. Tanita regular, 15.5. DEXA, 15.6.
Very close.
Extremely close. Extremely. Calipers, I'm still within, I'm 1.5 points difference. So it still demonstrates that the Tanita scale is pretty good and that calipers are pretty good.
Which the Tanita scale was surprising to me personally, and I know you guys a bit too. I didn't have a whole lot of faith in those things. I mean, I've seen too many things where you drop in a quarter and hold on to it, you know, and it tells you what your fat is. And I thought it'd be far off, but those two settings, it is a little weird to have those two settings, but as long as you understand that one gets something that's close to or comparable to DEXA figures, and then one gets close to what you would get with a normal skin fold caliper test, then it's actually really useful. Mm-hmm. And we found it to be consistent across the board and being close. In fact, with me, they were very close with those. So, yeah.
This morning, too, I was just telling these guys, so I'm 184 last test, but this morning I was 180.0. And, you know, you get on the scale and it kind of like jumps back and forth. I almost hit 179.
You just stayed there hoping that it would.
I know. Yeah. I was spitting just right in the bathroom floor trying to lose a little weight. So anyways, that's really good. I haven't been focused so much on weight loss this last few months. Kind of just want to raise my FTP, but I don't know. I still want to beat Chad.
No, we were using, which scale were we using, Nate? Because I know that people are going to be asking us what scale we used. It was the Tanita Ironman. Was it the BC554?
I don't know.
There's like it on Amazon.
It's
it
got
looks
like
the
glass
same.
On it. Yeah, that's so. We've used two Tanitas though. Actually, we've used an older one that I bought like 7 years ago or something.
Yeah, it looks.
And that reads the same as the one that I just bought. That's like three times as much.
It's like 50. So the older one, there's a BF680W. That's a terrible name. Sorry, guys. But it's the Tanita BF680W. That one's $60 on Amazon. Pretty cheap. And we found it to be spot on. So really good. We didn't notice that the new scale gave us any type of increased accuracy. It did give us different metrics, but a lot of them are kind of guessing metrics. Like
look at them.
Yeah, and those ones don't matter to me. It's tough to get some data from that. But if you just want to break down your body fat percentage, then I would recommend that BF680W. It's pretty darn cheap.
It's been pretty reliable, yeah.
Works well.
It was like, so my final DEXA in July, I had about a 3 month gap.
What do you mean final?
My third final, I hope. It was about a 3 month gap. In the process of it, I actually dipped down really low in body weight and my power was going with it. So I started addressing my protein intake and really focusing on that and timing it, and et cetera. And my FTP is on the rebound. Weight's come back up a bit. But between, you know, the April test and the July test, I lost another 3 pounds. I lost another 3.4% in body fat, actually gained 3% in lean mass. So the muscle's coming back up, power's coming back up with it.
3.4 points, not percent. You went down to 11.1%.
Okay, yeah, exactly. So what's interesting here, again, is how they compare. The DEXA had me at 11.1, and then that Tanita regular, 10.8. Super close. So once again, another endorsement for that scale. And then the calipers, and of course we do this on ourselves, so there's room for error there, but we try to keep it pretty consistent. Had me at 7%, and then the Tanita athlete had me at 5.2. So that was probably the biggest discrepancy, but they're still pretty close. I mean, usably close.
Yeah.
That's really cool. Stuff. So we also saw an article this week showing Chris Froome doing DEXA. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is really super interesting for us.
It's on Cycling Tips, and it's called Chris Froome's Lab Results Analyze, Just How Good is a 3-time Tour de France Champion? And Dr. Stephen Lane actually did the analysis on the report, and he's a good guy. He uses Trainer Road with his athletes, too. He broke down, which this is crazy, he broke down his body fat. When Chris Froome did this test, he was, and I'm doing air quotes here, he was out of shape. He wasn't in tour form.
Well, he was in training. Is it his weight for training, mm-hmm. right? This is like what he maintains year round,
which isn't his Grand Tour weight, right?
Yeah. That's necessarily higher. I mean, you get so susceptible to illness and just all forms of breakdown when you ride that fine line between being as light as possible and still performing well.
Having said that, it still wasn't as if he was very overweight, right? At that point, according to this, he was 9.6%, right?
DEXA.
That's DEXA. Generally, once again, that's generally close to around double what you would find at the skinfold caliper test. 9.6%, and that's his training weight. That's not his Grand Tour weight. They mentioned that once he got to the Tour de France in 2015, he was at 5.5%. And that's crazy.
I don't ever want to do that.
You would be around, if you were to do a normal skinfold caliper test, that'd be somewhere around 2-3%. And that's freakishly thin, man. We've seen it on TV.
That's why
it looks that way.
This is world-class special genetics. Don't do that at home.
This is the highest of heights.
For those that don't
very best in the world.
For those that don't know what happens to your body when you're really trying to run that line of getting your body fat down so much and then maintain power, it is a serious struggle to maintain that. And it's not a comfortable way to live. It's even arguable if it's really a healthy way to live, right?
That's actually something that I really want to talk about Chad, because Chad, although I think Chad's FTP for him has dropped embarrassingly a lot for him. And I don't know, I think part of it is the pressure of this test and you losing fat too quickly. Mm-hmm. Like if you would have slowed it down.
Agreed.
You probably could be in the same place January.
Oh yeah, I could have done this far more sensibly. I prioritized weight loss above all else. I wasn't even concerned with performance. I wasn't concerned with power. I mean, to some extent, I was
looking super lean though.
But yeah, and I was more concerned with aesthetics and watching the numbers drop and getting favorable DEXA results, being able to brag about it on the podcast. Yeah, so my motivations were a little out of whack. But
do you want to talk about where your FTP has fallen from and where it is now?
I think I drove it up to roughly 360 and was, you know, heavy at the time comparatively, like at 185. And then as my weight came down, like I was mentioning, the power was going with it. And now I reassessed recently and I'm all the way down at like 315, 312.
Striking distance.
So it's quite a lot, but it's going to come back up fast because now that's the emphasis. That's the concern.
Especially,
that's my focus.
Yeah, and with on our blog, you can trainerroad.com/blog, or you can just look up there and click on the link when you log into Trainer Road or check out the website. But you broke down your training plan. Mm-hmm. Your FTP is about to go way up because you're focusing in on sustained power build and then going into some cyclocross stuff.
That's a really cool blog post. So if you want to see what Chad's going to do, and I'm pretty much doing the exact same thing that he's doing, check out our blog, blog.trainer.com.
Yeah.
An interesting thing is, Chad, do you think you are, with your weight loss, if you're going to do a hill climb, think you were faster before you started this or after?
I basically lost power. So the weight loss didn't compensate for the power loss. So I hindered myself.
Hmm. And I started out with a higher body fat, but I'm really only maybe 3 months behind you in like the trend for what body fat is. But plus I wasn't as good as an athlete as you were. My FTP right now, 290. And I'm before my sinus surgery, it was 295, but I was 190. Mm. Now I'm 193. So I've lost 13 pounds between that 5 watts, but I think my power will keep going up. So it'll be interesting to see. Chad, are you going to try to keep your body fat here in race power?
Yeah, I think this is a comfortable spot for me.
So at cyclocross in 16 weeks, you have a goal FTP.
Yeah, and I haven't crunched numbers too closely just yet. I'll see what, you know, based on my anticipated improvement or rate of improvement, if I can actually reach this over the course of 16 weeks, 15 weeks. But I'd like to get back up to 360. And I think it's reasonable.
Disclaimer on that too. Chad can say that because he has history and he understands where his body has operated.
I'm not going to go to 360 in 16 weeks.
And I think a lot of people, they aim for a number with an FTP test or they're shooting for one.
And
if you're new to it or anything else, that can be really tough. In Chad's case, he can do that because he has years of experience of training with power and he knows where his body should be operating at a certain given weight and everything else. So So that's why it's easy for Chad to throw out that number. If you don't have that number, don't necessarily chase one.
Yeah, don't
obviously
just pick a number and then just
Coach
bury
Chad
yourself trying to get there.
Yeah.
50 yeah, watts. This is based on a lot of history.
Oh, Chad, what's your highest FTP you've had?
385.
And how old were you?
34.
So now you're 44, 10 years later.
Exactly.
And you're looking for 25 watts less.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and I hope that's reasonable. I think it is because I touched 360 earlier this year and then kind of realized I overdid it and then the whole weight loss thing kicked in. So, but I think it's feasible.
So how are you changing your eating now that like you want to maintain the body fat, maintain the weight too?
Yeah, I picked up a lot of good habits over the course of this. So timing my protein intake was a big one. Typically, I would do a hard workout. I wouldn't really prioritize my eating. It would just kind of come when it came. And now I'm very much aware of the fact that I need to eat after or what happens when I don't eat after. I mean, there are benefits to it. They're not benefits that work for me, not considering what my goals are. So I'm timing my nutrition intake far better, and it's having an immediate impact on my performance. So some of the stuff I learned over the course of this, while it may have been a tough way to learn it, I did learn, and I'm going to start applying that. And I think that, once again, it's reasonable for me to get back up to where I basically left off.
So how have you been timing it differently?
Just in a nutshell, not skipping meals after hard workouts. Hmm. That was the biggest thing.
Interesting.
Just missing that so-called window. And
I know it's gotten a lot easier to lose weight, actually. I think it's usually they say it's the opposite, but for me, the first couple months were by far the hardest, and now I'm just like...
Was that more of just curbing desires and cravings and everything else?
Yep, it was the desire and the cravings, maybe? Yep. Yeah. And now, like, yesterday my workout was, I think, 950 calories, and then I had a...
That's a good workout.
Yeah, so it's, as you get stronger, too...
Yep. Which one was it, do you know?
It was the second workout in...
Avalanche Spire.
Yeah, Avalanche Spire. Yeah,
I did the same one.
It's an hour and 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. It is. Yeah, Chad, we should be doing the same one every day. So, sensible dinner. And after that, if I do a big workout like that, so on my harder days, I try to have more carbs at lunch because Chad and I think are both doing our workouts around 4 o'clock.
This would be the takeaway is that I've matched my energy intake. So, you know, what I eat based on that day's workout. If I know it's going to be long, slow stuff, then I know I don't need a lot of carbohydrate. I know I don't need a lot of food, period. I mean, obviously I still need to maintain protein, et cetera, but it's, if it's not going to be a hard day, I don't stock up.
And especially now since I'm focused more on gaining my FTP. So on those bigger days for lunch, I might even get fries. With my, which is pretty cool.
I've witnessed this, yeah.
But if
yeah.
I'm going to have a, so for morning, I have a protein shake. Lunch, if I have a hamburger and fries, but I'm going to do a 1,000 calorie workout, you can usually, especially depending where you go, he's like, okay, my lunch is, let's say 800 calories. I'm doing a 1,000 calorie workout, and then I'll have a sensible dinner and then water. Mm-hmm. I pretty much like canceled out my entire lunch, but fueled it for my workout.
Yeah.
So I'm really only having for the day a protein shake and then some like chicken and vegetables for dinner.
Mm-hmm.
But I still am like improving and getting a good workout in.
And, yeah.
That's,
you know, and we haven't been talking about my figures. We won't go into them, but the one that my takeaway from this, number one, has been, just like you guys have said, fueling your workouts and looking at food just as fuel instead of looking at it as an indulgence or a social thing as well or a customary thing in the sense that, no, you eat three meals a day and you eat dinner. And dinner here in the States is the largest meal of the day, but that's when you need the least amount of fuel because you're not going to be doing unless you're doing a crazy workout right after, but that's a whole different story. So that's one thing that I've taken away from this. But then the other thing that I've taken away from all of this is the value of sleep. So I didn't take my third, and the value of sleep in helping your weight loss.
You have a newborn now, so you know now.
Exactly. And that has made my ability to keep dropping body fat really difficult, having a total lack of sleep. Yeah. That goes so far. If you can get to bed early and you can have a good night's sleep and really allow your body to recharge, that's something that I think is overlooked by a lot of people in you know, losing weight, it helps so much. So
one other thing to say about this, I had a small lunch, small breakfast the other day, and I did Mount Field, which is like 3 12-minute efforts of kind of sweet spot. I think it's 85%.
Yeah.
So it's, I really like that workout because it burns a lot of calories, but it's still easy and doesn't stress me out. I am still now that my fat's lower, I'm indulging a bit. My daughter had gymnastics, and I said, let's go to ice cream afterwards.
Yeah.
That was fun. I think I calculated I had 500 calories of ice cream.
Which there's a lot to say about that, too. It's easy with cycling, and for all of you triathletes and cyclists, especially triathletes, because they get very focused on optimizing everything, and it's easy to suck the fun out of the sport and out of your life in general. And mm-hmm. And while winning on race day is incredible, and for me, I do tend to sacrifice all things for that, it isn't everything. You still have to enjoy stuff.
It's there's a book called Faster that we have a book club at Trainer Road, and we just read that. It's I really like that book, and he talks about...
He being Michael Hutchinson. There's a couple books titled Faster. This is the Michael Hutchinson one.
Dr. Michael Hutchinson. Yeah, he's fantastic.
Yeah, but he talks about getting, what's it called, morale points?
Yep.
He's like, I have to go out and go to the bar or eat something, and that will fuel my morale points so that the next day... I don't skip the workout entirely because I'm feeling so bad. And you know what? That ice cream I had the next day, probably those extra carbs helped a bit because the next day I had a great workout. Avalanche Spire is not an easy workout.
There's got to be some interim joy too. You can't just work toward an event and put all your emphasis on just how you're going to perform that day and just suffer in the meantime.
And so many things happen on race day out of your control too. I mean, I was thinking about that the other day. You know, you build up for an Ironman, or let's say you build up for Kona, and that's like your big thing, and you're putting all your eggs in that basket, or the Olympics right now. People mm-hmm. wait 4 years, right? And I was watching a track and field runner, and he false started. And he was out and disqualified, like a mm-hmm. false start. So 4 years of just completely, you know, sacrificing everything to false start and miss your chance to do anything.
Simon,
that'd be terrible.
Simon Whitfield, gold medal in the Olympics, uses Trainer Road. He had it in the Olympics where getting on the bike, he couldn't get his foot into the shoe. He like glanced the barrier, someone hit him from behind, out of it. Ugh. 4 years.
Yeah. So, and imagine
Jonathan, you had something like that too.
Totally. National championships, prepped for it. And then a wheel that I got, the carbon fiber didn't get shaved around the side. So it sliced my tire, gave me 3 flats. And I had like an 8 mile walk in shale at 10,000 feet. It was terrible.
That's the culmination of your season.
Yeah. And to be honest, for that race, I had sacrificed my happiness at that point. Like I had gotten rid of everything. And I was pretty bummed about that because at that point I was genuinely
so
depressed.
Focused,
man. It was really tough. Yeah. It was really tough. So at the same time, there is a balance to be ridden. And I fully believe that if you want to be the best and you are at a competitive level, you do need to sacrifice things that are going to make life less enjoyable. But if it's worth it to win, that's one thing. But always keep things in perspective. Maybe
there's always a balance to be struck.
The other part of this, which is will give people anxiety. Chad, we've never heard your miss the Nationals podium story by how much?
I think it was 0.9 seconds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can tell right now looking at Chad's face that it still stings.
I mean, I feel like if I could have gone back then, I could have changed your tire pressure and you would have...
Could have done just about anything. I could have taken one less drink from my bottle. I could have passed a guy just that much sooner. I mean, there's could have done anything to make up a fraction of a second.
Yeah. Does it haunt you?
A bit. It did. It kind of took the wind out of my sails. I got to say, it was like, that's as close as I've gotten and I just haven't found the inspiration to try that hard since then.
Right. Yeah, it's tough.
It's like the cross is here. Yeah. You ready to move forward?
It's time for something new.
One thing that really quick that I wanted to, because we didn't spend too much time talking about Froome, and I just want to touch on the two main highlights. So first of all, this is what Stephen Lane's words. He says this, certainly he's talking about his VO2 max and peak power output, but he says, this certainly rates Froome as a world-class athlete, and when his absolute VO2 max values are compared to his optimal race weight, he attains an even more impressive value of 89.5 millilols or milliliters per kilogram per minute. So he's pretty high, but he's not the highest that's been recorded. I think Greg LeMond, is the highest recorded. So
I think those numbers are a little inflated too. They used a ramp protocol where he went up in power every minute, and you can hit your VO2 max or your peak VO2 uptake and still forge on for another minute or two.
Yeah.
So if they're using those slightly inflated numbers, then that can slightly inflate that actual VO2 number. I mean, there's no doubt this guy's...
Couldn't they do a gas exchange, like where you... I mean, not the gas exchange, but you actually put on the mass that you use for a VO2 max test, and they can measure where you hit your VO2 max at your power? Yeah, like during a ramp test.
I'm not entirely clear.
I thought that he would have been
really know either.
Masked up too for this too, that he would have that set up, but
I don't know.
You know, the one takeaway from this is that Chris Froome isn't the fastest, or isn't the he doesn't have the highest VO2 max. Let's just keep it straight there. Highest VO2 max measured, he doesn't have it. However, when you look at his power to weight ratio, and also his power to weight ratio isn't anything that's you know. You know, stratospheric or anything else, but
well, see, and that's another thing. That's another kind of issue with this test is they just cut it off at 4 millimoles. Mm-hmm. 4 millimoles. That doesn't mean that's his lactate steady state. Some people ride at higher levels than that, substantially higher levels than that, and they can maintain that for you know close to an hour. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a who says 4 millimoles is where he evens out in terms of lactate clearance.
Yeah, and they approximate 420 watts where his FTP was, and that was under ambient conditions. And then they said even higher under hot and humid conditions.
That's baffling.
Which none of us understand, right?
No, we don't understand that.
Yeah.
This goes to another point, though, is like at a Grand Tour rider, it's not just VO2 max and your power to weight. It's how can you recover over 3 weeks?
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Your and equipment, that's, your
if you could test that somehow, that would be something that Team Sky or all these teams would be chasing in a GC guy.
Yeah.
Because in many cases, that's more important than having the highest VO2 max or the highest anything else. It's your ability to recover. I mean, obviously it is. That's what the whole doping scandal was about all throughout the early 2000s.
Yeah, it was
you know?
Recovering for all those days.
Yeah. And then, so that puts him roughly at about...
early 2000s.
Yeah,
you're being generous.
Yeah.
Not just the early 2000s.
Probably still going on. And so... that puts him roughly at about 6.5 watts per kilogram during his optimal race weight, it says. So that's FTP, remember.
Yeah, 6.5.
That's beast.
My God.
I got very close. I got to 4.85. That's the highest I've been. Chad, what's the highest you've been?
I've touched 5. So.
Touched 5.
Yeah.
And Chad?
Nate.
Sorry, Nate.
3.5, what I am right now.
Yeah.
But I'm going to get 4 soon.
Yeah.
Hopefully by end of cyclocross season.
It's tough when you're 6'6", too. So, yeah. Anyways, we thought that was interesting. It's a really cool article. Look into it. The cool part is you can kind of compare your performance in some respects, or at least get some type of an idea of where Chris Froome is in relation to you.
So
probably won't make you feel great. But
so, again, 6'6", at 180 pounds, that's 61.6 kilograms. For me to be at 6.5 watts per kilogram, 530 FTP.
Oh.
I'd be the national TT, world TT champion.
Yeah, you'd be a beast.
That's like Miguel Indurain.
Right. All right, so let's get into questions. Let's go to Chadwick's question. He says, is there any drawback to training on lower quality sleep? This hits home for me. In a case where I'm sticking to a trainer road plan and scheduled built-in rest, but I have a night of lower quality sleep, are there different physiological adaptations as opposed to coming off a good night's rest, assuming that I can still compete or complete the workout as prescribed? P.S. I'm now addicted to indoor training on trainer road, even though it's summer. My wife thinks I'm crazy for going out for going outdoor rides while I have the chance given our long Canadian winters. Keep up the amazing work.
Chadwick, they're not necessarily different physiological adaptations. They're just blunted ones. And if you just have an occasional poor night's sleep, then maybe it's just an occasional bad workout. The concern is when it starts happening routinely, and your performance will fall off. And, you know, maybe you're finishing the workouts as prescribed, but that kind of tells me that you could probably do more rested. You know, all of our recovery takes place basically when we sleep. All the stuff that we need to you know forge that adaptation takes place largely when we're sleeping. And if you're shortchanging that sleep, then obviously your performance is going to suffer for it.
This is something I've been battling is the sleep apnea. I had surgery to kind of fix that. Just last night, my wife's like, you're snoring a ton. I'll snore like 3 times. And she says, like, wake myself up and roll over and then do it again. So
and that's what your surgery was supposed to counter, right?
Yes. And it made it worse.
Oh,
I could, I'm still healing though. So I'm not, I don't know. It's kind of depressing though, but
I'll
sleep 9.5 hours a night and still be tired, wake up with a headache, that's like a sign of sleep apnea. So I feel you, Chadwick. I still just go do the workouts, try to get more sleep and rest.
Yeah, and you can still you know gain some adaptation, some training benefit from it. It just isn't going to be maximal. So and when it happens occasionally, don't sweat it. A poor night's sleep, you can still have a great workout. It's when it happens routinely that things start to fall apart.
I'm entering that routine. Actually, that routine is there, and it's pretty rough right now. So yeah, this question hits home, Chadwick. And I honestly, I've noticed, I haven't noticed a huge impact on my training yet, but I've noticed an impact outside of that, just in my freshness and sharpness and everything else.
I was going to say, I haven't noticed this, but you get stupid. I haven't noticed that with Jonathan, well, just so you know.
Thank you.
But I haven't seen you very much. But.
Well, that's another point, too. I mean, there's a neuromuscular component, too, right? So you can actually start training bad habits. I mean, you start riding sloppily. You may not even notice it, but the fact is you're starting to reinforce motor patterns that maybe aren't desirable.
That's a great point. Yeah, really good point. And Chadwick, you also had a question about CTL and TSB, but we've kind of hit that one to death recently. So we decided to write a blog post on it, and it's up on our blog. You can check it out, trainerroad.com/blog, and there'll be some more info on that. So let's go into Peter's question. I have a friend that uses Trainer Road 5 to 6 days a week in the summer in Colorado, where it is perfect every day and beautiful rides everywhere. He does go outside on the weekends, but gets up at 5 a.m. to ride on the trainer every day during the week, and then skips out on fun weekday races, rides because he's tired. Can you recommend that he goes outside to ride with his friends? He doesn't have very many, and limit his training and limit his training or trainer rides in the nice weather, doing intense interval workouts. And tell him his annual miles must actually be traveled and not sitting in front of a TV. Thanks, guys. Love the podcast. So I wanted to put this in for two reasons. Number one, the comment of annual miles must be traveled, not sitting in front of a TV. Annual miles. I just wanted to squash annual miles. And if you are a cyclist that is listening to this podcast, chances are you want to improve your performance. And if you were going to measure your performance, don't do it with miles.
Yeah, we get a lot of people who submit support tickets or coaching questions. And one of the tidbits of information they share with us is their annual mileage, which to some extent is impressive. You know, if you're logging a couple thousand miles a year, I mean, that's in and of itself kind of impressive. But first off, you know, what'd you do the year prior to that? I mean, does that even compare? It could be half as much as you did the last year. But what it really boils down to is what were the quality of those miles? I mean, I've seen guys who noodle along, will pedal 10 pedal strokes and then coast until they're damn near come to a standstill and then start pedaling again. There's no quality there, but yeah, they logged a mile or two. So this mileage count isn't very useful unless you frame it in a different another context, that being power.
In the business world, we call these vanity metrics. And there'll be something like, my site gets so many hits or users click on this so many times. But when an investor comes in, they're really concerned on certain things that you do or how much money you make that really matter for the business. Now, imagine if Team Sky was like, oh, how many miles do you ride a year?
can you imagine that?
You ride 6,000, you're on Team Sky, right? They don't care one bit. They don't ask a single person. You know why? Because that metric does not matter to anyone to get faster. I mean, it could be if you get a lot of TSS, a lot of training stress, and you do a lot of structured riding, you might have a lot of miles. You might have less, depending on what you're doing. But it's not it's like how many RPMs does your car get up to?
Yeah,
it like, does that mean, my car's faster than yours?
Yeah, if you're trying to rack up miles, then yeah, by all means, count miles. But if you're trying to get faster, that's...
Yeah, what's your goal in life?
Yeah.
Be faster or just get a lot of miles? Yeah. I went with a bunch of nice guys, but everyone was over like 65, and we rode for like 3.5 hours. And we got some miles, but not that many. And it was just not a workout for me. It wasn't even like a good recovery because it was just like tired on the bike.
Yeah,
for going so slow, my body was tired just sitting there.
It's a quantity measurement, and we need to at least also measure quality. Maybe just measure quality.
Yeah, so that was the first reason I wanted to, or first thing I wanted to point out there, and then the second thing was he says he uses Trainer Road 5 to 6 days a week. Which, by the way, Peter, I like your friend, and I think you like him too. He uses Trainer Road 5 to 6 days a week. I've been asking people around, like, how much time they spend on the bike, and these are people that are cyclists and mountain bike racers and everything else, asking them how much time they spend on the bike each week, and a good amount of people that are serious racers, mountain bike racers, these people I've been talking to, they're spending 10 or up, right? 10 to 15 hours a week, right? In fact, I was talking to some guy at the crit last night, and he said, yeah, it was a great week last week. I got in 20 hours. And 20 hours, by the way, That's a lot of time. That's a quality, or that's you're talking about quantitative measurement, right?
Could be 20 hours at 15 miles per hour on the road.
Exactly. Yes. Now, if you can distill that and bring it down, which, by the way, I know that you did do quality in there, Dave. You're the one, you're probably listening to this, so I know that you did do quality in this, but the one thing that I can really speak for, which has really helped me, and I find a lot of reason in indoor training with mountain biking, is you can do 5 to 6 workouts a week. They're 30 minutes to 90 minutes and usually fall around the hour mark. And that's short. And if you have a bike set up on the trainer, it's so easy. You just get in your gear, you get out there and you do that. I recently have been doing a workout on the trainer. And then after that, I get out and I go outside and do whatever ride I need to do. Or I'll just split that up during the day. But it just makes sense. It makes you faster. And especially with crazy drivers on the roads and everything else, man, it just makes sense. So yeah, Peter, your friend isn't that bad. Your friend actually has a lot of things going for him.
I love your friend, Peter.
Yeah. Yeah, you're asking the wrong guys to recommend outdoor riding.
Colin, love it all, guys. The software is top-notch. Podcast is amazing. And you guys just plain rock. I honestly logged in on my wife and kids' accounts to give you multiple five-star ratings.
Hey, how do you rate in iTunes? I tried to rate our own podcast, and I couldn't figure it out. Do you just do it online?
You do it online or through iTunes, the app. I don't think you can do it from your phone.
The podcast app? Oh, the iTunes app or the podcast app?
iTunes.
Oh, you can't do it through your phone?
Yeah, I don't know if you can.
Okay, I couldn't figure it out through my phone.
I've only rated podcasts through iTunes, the actual
desktop app. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Hint.
That was a tutorial.
No, I'm just kidding.
All right. So now to get down to it. I started using Trainer Road midwinter and started with an 8-minute test. I tested at 334 watts and still felt like I left a little bit on the table, but I've never done structured training before, so I left it as is. I started the 70.3 mid-volume base, got through the first 3 weeks with about 99% adherence. Good job on that. To the plan, and was really looking forward to the rest week since I felt pretty spent. After the rest week, which I stuck to pretty closely again, I got back into the increasingly difficult weeks, and I couldn't hack it. I kept having to bail on the short VO2 intervals, mid-length sweet spot stuff, and could only really execute well on the longer aerobic rides. I decided to bail on the plan after about week 6.5, and took almost an entire week off to completely recover, then get at it again. I did the 8-minute test again, feeling well-rested, and couldn't even get close to the same result. I tested about 15 to 20 watts lower, sub 320, and was quite discouraged. In this several-month period, I didn't lose weight, increased my sleep and recovery time, diligently kept my bike set up exactly the same tire pressure, turns of the crank on the trainer, and have two huge fans cooling me quite well, did all of my testing. This guy listens to the podcast, you can tell. Did all my testing and training at the same time of day. I'm very discouraged because all the hard work doesn't seem to be paying off, and I'm wondering if there's some other variable I'm not considering, perhaps, or some other explanation you can think of why a 35-year-old guy coming off of no structured cycling training, just running but lots of it, can't increase his threshold or even maintain it. Thanks, and keep up the great work.
Okay, Colin, so let's go back and pick our way through this. You say you're new to structured training, and you jumped into a mid-volume plan. That, I think, is probably mistake number one. If you're new to structured training and indoor training where the quality is super high and they're strenuous workouts, diving into not the deep end, but the middle of the pool is maybe a kind of risky way to go about it.
And he didn't even start with sweet spot base, which is normally what we recommend. He went right into specialty mid-volume 70.3.
So there's another...
Or you could do the triathlon low-volume base too.
Yeah, in any case, I think you might have just pushed it a little too far, a little too fast. The fact that you got through your first 3 weeks and 99% adherence, kudos to you, but you were really, and you put it in caps, really looking forward to your rest week. Mm. Says you were carrying a lot of fatigue into that first rest week. And yeah, you should be looking forward to the recovery weeks. You should recognize that your body needs a little bit of a downturn. You need time to absorb, heal, et cetera. But if you're really looking forward to it, it says you've probably, again, pushed it a little too far, a little too fast. And yeah, you took a week off. That doesn't mean your body's going to rebound and reset in that single week, especially considering that week could have had all different forms of stress. I don't know what your life consists of outside of cycling, but it may not have been as recuperative as you thought it was. I'm not sure if when you did reassess, you did it right after that week off, because coming back after a layoff and diving into a hard workout and an assessment is about as hard as it gets. Is tough. It might not be an actual a quality measure of what you can do. But this is, I think it's just boiling down to you just kind of beat yourself into a pretty tough spot and you haven't fully rebounded from it yet.
I felt this way too with lower carb intake during the weight loss. As the plan goes on, I'm like, this is getting harder and harder.
And all you can do is that low intensity stuff.
Yeah.
Yep.
Which...
And something else to consider, you mentioned that you were a runner and you did a lot of it beforehand, and this is your first crack at structured training. two things come to mind. You could have a bike setup that's completely wonky, putting you into a situation where it's really tough to actually put out power or anything else, and that could be causing issues. Who knows? You may have gotten a bike fit. That's just one variable you didn't mention there. The other thing that I would keep or that I would bring up too is if you're a runner and did a lot of it, you're a really competitive guy, and you jumped straight into the deep end, so to speak, with this, that makes sense too. You're a type A-driven person. But it takes time to build that type of fitness that you need to go well on the bike, too. It does take a long time. And jumping in at a base level with maybe a low – and that's the best thing. Pick a low-volume plan, and you'll know if it's too easy, and that'll be readily apparent. Yeah. And you can add more on later on. But
well, yeah, too little stress. Really
too little
not,
stress. Yeah, that's probably a better term. Yeah.
And you didn't say anything about nutrition, so I'm not sure how you nourish or how well you eat. But this change in training, and you know, it inflicts a pretty big demand on your body in general. And if you're not eating too well, that's going to be a major setback too.
I've noticed one thing that I've done. If I'm too low on carbs, this is like my kind of test to see if really carbs are holding me back. And I don't recommend this. There's not any science behind this. But so let's say Thursday, I've got a big workout. Or it's like a Saturday or Sunday, and it's a 90-minute, you know, hard workout. And I'm like, I'm never going to be able to do this. The night before, I'll eat a high-carbohydrate meal like big pizza, mm-hmm. BJ's favorite, hold the olives, extra nice. Pineapple. maybe get some ice cream with that, like really like have a cheat meal.
Yeah.
And then the next day, especially if I do the 4 o'clock for lunch, something else that Jonathan just winces. I love Popeyes.
Oh.
With I'll get the chicken tenders with fries and the biscuit with honey and butter.
Nate has an iron gut.
And then I'll have my 4 o'clock workout.
Nate has no science behind this. Let's be clear.
Yeah. Well, okay, the science is it's a heck of a lot of carbs to ingest.
Yeah.
And but then I'll do my workout and I'll be like, I'll stop and I'll like calibrate my power meter again and again because I'm like, this is too easy. This is not hard. Yeah. What's wrong with this?
Yeah, that's a dead giveaway that you're underfueled during
yeah,
the hard
but
workouts.
I can't do, I wish I could, but I can't do that. If I was on the Tour de France, I could do that every day,
yeah.
But I can't do that every day without my weight going up. So there's some balance in there that I can probably get. So right now what I do is just a higher carbohydrate meal for those big workouts for the night before. But if I combine the two and even I'll have maybe even a big breakfast with carbs, like pancakes or something, it's a great three meals in a row. You feel really cool, but that will tell me that it's carbohydrates and not just my body like having too much stress.
Yeah. Makes sense. Yeah.
People are just going to, gotta get a pizza tonight.
Yeah. Ricky, he has a question. He says, what earbuds do you use while cycling on the trainer? I actually have mine right by me. They're the Jaybird X2s. They're the ones I use. I used to use ones that were plugged in, and it's just such a pain, especially when you get a cord that knocks on your frame.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Wireless is the way to go.
Wireless is the way to go. So Jaybird X2s for me, and I can't have anything over the ears. But
I used to do that.
I feel like I have anymore. Ovens on my head. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. Yeah. But what do you guys use?
Yeah, I use earbuds too. I use the Klipsch. I think it's the X12i. They're pricey. I'll just tell you right from the go. They are expensive, but they're the best headphones or earbuds that I've ever used.
Those ones are the best sounding ones.
How much are they?
$350.
Yeah, they're not cheap. The Jaybirds do not have the best sound quality. Yeah. Let's be real. But
yeah, these things nest so well, and they come with a whole array of little ear fittings, so you can find just the right fit. Mm-hmm. And they're perfect in that they let enough. And you know, I don't condone this, but I do ride outdoors with headphones. But these are just the right balance between allowing me to hear what's going on outside of the headphones and hear a reasonably high quality of music.
Mm. And I use the Beats Power Beats. Which I think they're not cheap either. What are they, $250, $300, somewhere in there?
Yeah, they're pretty expensive.
Yeah. One thing that I read online is those can break. I'm very gentle with them, and I put them in the case every time. Mm. But there's a little weak point in them that could break. Mm. I'm actually excited. Apple, new iPhone's coming out, and there's all the thing about they're not going to have a headphone jack.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping, because they bought Beats, that they will have a nice wireless earphone that are not... They're probably going to be like $100, but $100 with mid-range quality that works, I'm cool with, rather than the $300 or something.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah, that
maybe
would
they
good.
Can even go, hopefully they just have one with the iPhone where they have some wireless ones.
Yeah, these Jaybirds, you can find the X2s for pretty cheap because they just came out with some new ones. These ones, I got them for $75. That's pretty cheap. They have good range. They sound great, and for the price, they're pretty good. And they've got a bunch of different little ear fittings on them. They work well. And they also can be paired to multiple devices at the same time and handle all that, which is nice. It's nothing too.
Yeah, the Beats don't do that. I have to like repair them every time I switch between iPhone to iPad, and that's annoying.
Yeah, so they've got some handy things to them. They've done a pretty good job with them. So, and you can find them for like I said, pretty darn cheap right now, because they just came out with some new ones that are slimmer, and they're kind of actually similar to the shape of the Klipsch headphones that Chad's talking about. They don't have a gigantic pod and a thing that sticks into your ear like the shape of a T almost.
Yeah, those Klipsch, hurt.
Yeah, the Klipsch is a nice little angled, almost like a spear, so to speak.
And yeah, they fit exceptionally well.
Yep, they're really, really good. So Scott, he says, I have a general question. I'm 57 years old and 2 weeks into the Sweet Spot Base 2 mid-volume training plan. And for those that don't know, that's the second half of our Sweet Spot base training plan. It's the one that we recommend most people follow with their base training. It seems like training continues intensity 3 days in a row while I am still sore from my previous training. Do I get through it? Or I do get through it, and I know it's supposed to be intense, but I wonder if there's an age adjustment I should apply. It seems that competitive riders typically ride and train 6 days a week, but so many that I know are much younger. It took me 2 years to discover that my best races are followed followed 2 solid days of rest. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so there you go, Scott. Maybe it takes you a little longer to recover, especially as you get older. This is absolutely the case, and specifically with that Sweet Spot base plan, and then even the Sustained Power one. That Wednesday workout is supposed to be recuperative or regenerative. If doing a workout at 70% intensity factor versus 60% or 0.55. is a better fit for you, then drop it down. You don't have to follow this exactly as planned. And I came up against the same thing. I did that Wednesday workout. I carried a little bit too much fatigue into yesterday's workout, and it was more of a struggle than it should have been because I was tired going into it. Couldn't elevate my heart rate. Everything was just so much harder. But I know if I had toned that Tuesday or that Wednesday workout down just 10%, made it truly regenerative. It would have been a whole different workout yesterday. And I'm catching this early in the cycle because I don't want to carry this forward. And then you bring up a good point. You can get through it, but should you? Absolutely not. Figure out how you can derive the most benefit from the most meaningful workouts. And those other ones, tone them down as necessary.
Hmm. You know, one thing that I feel a lot of the time I'll be doing a mid-volume plan or a high-volume plan, and I'll have days back-to-back that are pretty tough. Mm-hmm. I personally, and this, I don't think this accurately reflects your situation, Scott. I'm younger. I'm 29 years old now. It feels like an old man already. But I'm 29 years old. When I go into those workouts, a lot of the time, because I don't want everyone to think that if you feel fatigue coming into the workout, that's bad, because I feel pretty darn tired and fatigued a lot of the time coming into them, and I can make it through. But in Scott's situation, he knows that after 2 days of rest, he does better coming into a race. That's a good indication. I know actually with racing and everything else that I do good. I do well if I have a hard workout the day before, right? So I know that I need to ignore it sometimes, that initial sign of rest. And once I get into the workout, I realize I'm fine. But getting tougher as you're going through the workout, that's a different story.
Yeah, you're going to have hard days and you're going to come into workouts tired. And that doesn't mean you skip the workout. It doesn't mean you even alter the workout if you don't have to. But it does mean you start watching for trends. If that's a consistent thing and performance is suffering as a consequence, something has to change.
And that's we wrote a blog post on this for a blog post for aging athletes and the implications and everything else on there. So,
and we do have plans to install some master's plans. It's going to be kind of a big deal considering how vast the project could be, but there is a distinct difference. And as we get older, it does take us longer to recover. Weeks need to be structured differently. Phases need to be structured differently. So there are adjustments. And like Jonathan said, there is a blog on this topic.
Mm-hmm. Brent, he says, hey guys, I really love the podcast and have listened to all of them. 5 stars. Time for my first question. On hot days, I notice quite a bit of salt buildup on my black bib shorts. It's a bit embarrassing since others around me don't have salty bibs. Do you guys know why this is happening or how I can prevent it? Am I just a salty sweater? Thanks, Brent.
Yeah, Brent, a week ago, I would have just given you a pithy little yes, you're a salty sweater, and it is accurate, but it just so happens I just watched a hydration video from Alan Lim, and this was addressed at length. And basically what it boils down to is the variability in your sweat sodium level is wide ranging. Some athletes shed a lot of sodium when they sweat, some not so much. The things that affect it, it mostly comes down to genetics. So you're kind of, you're stuck with what you got. It also ties to sweat rate. Obviously you sweat a lot, there's more potential for sodium loss. Your dietary sodium intake, you eat a lot of salt, you're probably going to sweat a lot of salt. And then there's a matter of heat acclimatization. As you acclimatize, your sweat becomes more dilute and you'll lose a little less sodium. And then there's even a gender difference. Men typically sweat out more sodium than women.
Did he say anything about one is better than the other, or just it is how it is?
Nope, it is how it is.
And do you...
It's not a good or bad thing.
Do you personally, do you guys get sweat stains?
I'm
like
a very
that?
Salty sweater.
Okay.
Nate? I'm medium.
Yeah, I've once in my life ever had salt... salt marks.
My helmet straps are caked all the time. And then sometimes it gets to my jersey. And in extreme situations, it gets down to my shorts.
Yeah. So I never really have that. I also eat a pretty... I eat, relatively speaking, I don't take in a lot of salt at all. In fact, like with my eggs and stuff in the morning, I don't put salt and pepper on them. I just eat normal eggs. Like it's just... Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with salt.
Yeah.
After I ride, I always like really crave something salty. I'll salt things that shouldn't be salted, like vegetables or something.
Yeah.
Yams, there wasn't salt on them.
And to be clear, my point with that comment was just that I don't know which one it comes down to, if it's that or if it's just the fact that I may just not be a salty sweater, too. Doesn't mean anything. Doesn't mean
your
that...
Your body's really good at regulating sodium, so I wouldn't give it too much thought.
Yeah, so don't worry about it, Brent. You said it's a bit embarrassing. It's not an embarrassment. It's just, don't worry about it.
It is what it is.
All.
Not much you can do about it.
Yeah, sorry. I never look at someone and be like, oh, he's salty, right? Like,
yeah, I've never, in fact, if anything, I've looked at those people and I've seen evidence of their hard work and I'm like, dang.
Yeah.
They're tough. You know, they went hard.
And in general, Chad, there's, at least for athletes, I know there's a couple cases where somebody can have, if they have a high sodium intake, they can have hypertension. That's not everyone in the world. Or that's kind of been debunked. The only thing athletes have to worry about is long workouts with absolutely no salt. Mm-hmm. Where you can get
electrolyte loss is a legitimate concern.
That's absolutely. The only Very way much, people yeah. die during marathons yeah. is hypernatremia.
Yep.
They don't get dehydrated that's and die. Just, they don't have salt enough sodium. Salt in their body. Yeah. They'll drink. It's usually what happens is a beginning runner, they'll have like a 5 or 6 hour marathon. And they'll just drink tons of water, and they'll actually flush all the electrolytes out of their body.
Especially their body on windy days, your mouth dries out, and you keep drinking. Yeah, mm-hmm.
And they're and hot in Chicago. It happened. People will get so low where you get something called hypernatremia, and your body will the electrical impulses just will stop firing. Right? Because I think that's what it. Don't quote me on that, but I believe that's what it is.
Sodium in there. Yeah. So the electrolyte. It's a severe electrolyte imbalance.
And you die. And the funny thing is, you could be taking salt. If you don't want the calories, you could be taking salt tablets the whole time. There's lots of products for that.
Yep.
And be just perfectly fine. Have no negative consequences.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean? Live and be fine. So.
And there are plenty of different products with that. And you mentioned Alan Lim, his Scratch Lab stuff I absolutely love.
Basically, the longer you ride, the more you sweat, the more you have to concern yourself with electrolyte balance. Yep. So you can't just pound the water. There's got to be some electrolyte content.
When do you guys start doing electrolytes?
As in like where at during in
like
my
how,
ride?
How many, like an hour workout, even a 90 minutes on the trainer, I don't either. Do any electrolytes.
Nope.
I do because I'm sponsored by Herbalife 24, and they have these little tiny packets of, it's like 10 calories, so the calories are negligible, but it's just an electrolyte packet. It's got a little bit of flavor, so it just makes my water a little more interesting.
Yeah.
Whether or not I've seen an improvement in the quality of my workouts due to that, I don't think so. I not over a 90-minute workout, but over a longer ride, I think those things are invaluable.
So I guess, Jonathan, when do you start doing it?
Because
you do these epic rides, yeah.
Yeah, 3 hours or above that's like my rule. Hmm. In rare situations, if it's an extremely hot day, I might add some in earlier on because I know I'll be sweating more. If it's a long day in the winter, then I won't be quite as concerned with it as well. The one thing Chad mentioned is sometimes it is nice to have something to give it a little bit of taste. And if you can get electrolytes with that, that's not going to be doing you any harm. So that's one thing that I do too.
My wife and I, she didn't want the calories, and we got her some Camelback
electrolyte tablets. They're like that 10 calorie thing.
Yeah.
She didn't like them as much because they're fizzy. So when she'd run with a thing in her hand, she'd open it up and it'd spray her in the face.
Yeah. Like,
you don't want when you're running.
Yeah. It's really weird. I don't know. And I guess some people crave a fizzy drink, when they're running or doing anything else, but I'm not a fan of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can take a bunch of pills too, if that's your,
those are hard too though. Cause if they get wet, they just disintegrate.
Yeah.
You can actually get two little scoops that you can put in your water that are, they don't really change the taste very much, but they do put some electrolytes in it.
And I've, like I said, with Scratch Lab stuff, I have a really sensitive stomach. Any type of sports drink, usually under, you know, hard exercise, gives me a bunch of GI distress. And
Jonathan, you have to train with me. Yeah, nutrition-wise.
I'm going to take you to Popeyes
and BJ's. And, you know, the thing, I've been a Dairy Queen Blizzard. That's what I've been craving. We can go. There's one close.
I would be so sick. It would be terrible. So that's that stuff doesn't seem to mess with my stomach. And I can also actually say the same thing for what Chad mentioned. Very rare that I find something that my stomach doesn't get messed up by. But that Herbalife stuff I've... riding with Dave, it hasn't messed with my stomach.
It's called Hydrate. It's just a little bit of powder that you dump into your bottle.
Disclaimer, we're not pyramid schemer people. It's just they like cycling, that company. And they sponsor a good team. So,
you know, EFS, we have some of that here too. I like that. It's got a little bit more for the calorie to electrolyte profile.
I have to water that down a little. If I go,
well, it scoops, right? So you can just do as much as you want or a little as you want.
Yeah, if I go recommended for what they say for a bottle, it's a little too strong for my stomach, so I'll water it. I go a half on that with EFS, but it's good stuff too. Yeah. Cool. Let's go into Robbie's question. He says, got a couple questions. First, how do you power your kicker at races for warming up? We mentioned this the other day on the podcast, and it's an Energizer inverter that we use. It's a tiny little guy, and it's not actually that expensive. I'm looking it up right now, but it's an Energizer. It's 120 watts or 180 watt cup inverter. It's $27. It's called the EN180, and you can find it on Amazon. So that's what we use there. And the next part of your question, you say, how bad does redlining at the start of a six-hour race affect my endurance for the race? Enough to negate the good positioning that I would get. And I assume he's talking about like a marathon mountain bike race because he's talking about good positioning. I assume it's okay for the two-hour races I do since I'm averaging around 20 beats per minute lower than my max. Thanks and keep up the good work racing and with the podcast. I never miss an episode. You guys are awesome.
Yeah, Jonathan could probably speak to this more than I can, but I'll just say it's just a question of how much anaerobic energy stores, you know, how much sugar you can afford to burn off, you know, how long that burst is going to be. Will the positioning outweigh the little bit of sacrifice you made to put yourself into that spot? I mean, there is a muscular toll as well, but I'm assuming this is kind of a short, couple minutes long at the most sort of affair. And it's nothing that's going to, I can't see it. If you're fit enough to do a 6 hour race, I can't imagine a couple minute effort setting you back very much. And the positioning can be pretty crucial.
Yeah, depending on the race. Now, if this is like a single track race and you're just on single track the whole day, that's one story, right? Mm-hmm. Or if it's the type of day where it may be muddy and the further ahead you can be in the group, the better off because the trail will be in better condition. Mm-hmm. Those are two things to consider, but in most cases, longer mountain bike races like that, you're going to have just plenty of chances, number one, in 6 hours to make some progress back up, but then you're also probably going to have fire road or something else because it's going to be pretty tough to stitch together 6 hours of contiguous single track. So the one thing I would say is if you find that these redlining at the start is costing you later on, if the race doesn't require it, don't worry about it quite as much and just focus on keeping a strong pace all the way through. What Chad said about the sugar and that's really is when we're talking about what it would deplete or anything else, that's it. But the 6 hour race, it's not as key.
Even with our North Star races, which were about a little more than an hour,
those are pretty start. Single track oriented.
Yeah, but there's still
but
enough.
There's still.
There's like a 10 minute climb to start with at least.
Yep.
And in those, I noticed just in the different times that I did it with a power meter, sometimes where I'd redline out, if at the end of those 10 minutes, I was ahead, I was farther, I traveled that distance, I climbed that hill faster when I didn't redline at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And I just was like, even my pace. Because you try to get on the trainer and Chad has lots of intervals like this where
race
you redline
intervals.
For like a minute,
and then try to hold your power for 9 minutes.
Hard.
Or just try to hold your power steady for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You put out more power. And, but this is because, too, my category was small. So I wasn't really going to, I wasn't getting behind, maybe stuck just a little bit behind people, but there was plenty of places to pass. The other thing I want to talk about are triathlon, because this is the same kind of start that people do. Mm-hmm. Half, maybe around 5 hours. Ironman, 11, 12 hours if you're a pretty quick guy or girl. People will, in that case, go, they'll gun it to get into a good swim group because there is a drafting benefit. But I think a lot of people don't need to necessarily do that, especially when you're in a big Ironman race. There's so many people, you could have a 2,000 person mass start.
Yeah.
And you're just going to be in a group and it's going to work out pretty well and save your energy for the marathon.
Yeah.
You know, in
if you have
many hours away.
If you have a pacing plan, whether it's in triathlon or something else, and you stick to that plan rather than just sticking to the pace around you, you're going to be all right.
Yeah.
You but know, that's.
If you're trying to win something or you're a pro, or I know in Sacramento where I go race, there'd be age group starts. And that one, there would be some benefit to kind of sprint out harder and get on the feet of like the guys in the lead group. Mm-hmm. So you come out with them and that there's a whole mental benefit. And I think in that case, it's good. But it's kind of the bigger the race, it's kind of counterintuitive, but the less likely you need to be able to sprint off because there'll be so many people around you to be able to draft. That you kind of get a drafting benefit the whole time and it negates the, we're in a smaller race. If I don't do that, I might swim the whole course by myself.
Totally.
And not get any drafting effect.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, I think that positioning a lot of the time in mountain bike races on long ones, it's overrated to some respect. If you're doing a race like Leadville, that's a road race. So that doesn't apply. You need to make sure that you're with like, you know, people that you're stuck together or a fast group since drafting definitely has a play. But if this is slow speeds and everything else, I'd recommend just pacing through.
So what do you guys think it'll be for cyclocross?
Oh, cyclocross is a different story.
It's going to be brutally fast the whole time.
Because
well, there's a lot of like positioning. Right?
Positioning is key.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, yep. That's what I think. That's what I've heard.
Yep. Yeah, positioning is key. So we'll be pinned from the gun, and then after that we'll be, you know. And here's the interesting thing. I was thinking about this the other night. So I'm taking a different approach than you guys. I'm actually going to general build and then going into the cyclocross plan instead of doing sustained power build. And the reason that I'm doing that is because my theory here is the profile of the course. So number one, we talked about this last time, but my body seems to respond to that shorter training very well. The shorter, more intense efforts, I do very well with that, and I can make increases in fitness quickly. But number two, some courses, just the profile of them, the speed at which you're going to approach these short, steep, grassy hills and everything else, you won't have a lot of speed because it'll be out of a tight turn and everything else. The course will necessitate a variable profile mm-hmm. if you were to look at it, right? It's going to be big surges constantly all the way through. So it's going to be interesting to see how that works out. It's a totally different pacing game with cross.
And that, the cyclocross plan has that.
Yes,
right?
It does.
And that's what we're going to get when we get into that.
Yep.
It'll be interesting. So we all have the same bike now. We all have stages.
Yep.
So, and then we're going to do Cross Vegas in the same heat.
Yes.
Which I am so not happy about, guys.
Yeah, it's the Wheelers and Dealers race, which is going to have some seriously fast people in it because there are some fast people in the bicycle industry. Mm-hmm. So
I need a couple slow people. If I just get lapped as soon as possible, because you can't, if I get lapped, no one will know where I am.
That's,
you know,
that's a great thing about cross, right?
Yeah, like 30 minutes in, no one knows where anyone is. Like, you kind of know where the lead guys are, but that's it.
Yeah. It's going to be fun. So,
yeah.
Well, that covers it for this week. Thanks for submitting the questions. Once again, you can do that at trainerroad.com/podcast. You can use the hashtag AskTrainerRoad. You can find us on Snapchat or on any other social platforms. Send us some questions on Snapchat, and we'll respond to them. I'll respond to them today even. Yeah, thanks, guys. We appreciate all the questions. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.